So I had finally had enough. I wanted to learn more about artificial intelligence, and I had, you know, quite frankly, some humor questions. And so I downloaded a new AI engine written in JavaScript, and the first thing I asked it was, I made a function, how many JavaScript programmers does it take to change a light bulb? The answer? Dog. Hey, hi, ho, guys. If you didn't get that joke, that's actually a joke about JavaScript being untyped. This is Nerd Roundup. Nerd Roundup, every week we get together, we talk about articles of the week with an emphasis to what the nerds are talking about this week. There is no agenda, really. I put together a list of stuff I've been reading. Most times the people don't read it who join. I have an open door policy for about 10 of my friends, and it varies between zero people showing up and maybe seven or eight. I think this week we've got myself and Greg Young. Greg, you with us, buddy?
Absolutely.
So you're going to, like, stay audio only?
I'll have to see if I can turn it on.
Because I'm not paying extra for, like, the video. Oh, there we go.
Oh, hold on. Let me put on my mask to make it even better.
So I, at the as traditional in this thing, I get a message at the last moment from Scott Ambler. He's being called into a strategy meeting. I said, Scott, I hope you get a lot of strategy in the meeting, because I guess that's what you go to get in those meetings. And he said he was going to try to get a lot of tactical strategy. And I, hey, Diego, good to see you, bud. James Grinning also came by and said, hey, can't make it, still have the grandkids. And I guess perhaps the grandkids prohibit him from, like, doing things on the computer. I don't really know.
Now, Daniel, this is actually going to maybe twist your brain a little bit, but in chess, there is actually a concept of tactical strategy.
Oh, my God. Scott Ambler, chess master. what would tactical strategy consist of?
It's basically, so tactics are going to be, for instance, exchanges. Whereas strategy is going to be very long-term things in chess. Like, for instance, I have left an isolated pawn all the way on the far right rank. This is a strategic advantage that over the course of 30 moves will be something interesting. But when you start dealing with things like chess engines, these things actually start becoming tactics.
Because it's evaluating multiple strategies.
Well, it's, I am assigning a point value to that strategic advantage, where that strategic advantage could cause me to do certain tactics. Because my evaluation comes out better with that strategic advantage, even though I might have lost on a tactical exchange.
I'm just really happy we live in a world that has so many overrated terms that no matter what you say, it's both silly and accurate at the same time. What you been up to this week, Greg?
Oh, it's been fun. I, last night, had somebody leave two laptops with me. And then bugger off.
Not on purpose?
Hours. For hours. No, like, I'm sitting in the hotel lobby, and he left two laptops with me.
He just said, hold these laptops, and left?
Yeah.
Did the cops show up?
Can you watch my laptops for a minute? Sure, no problem. Now, a couple hours go by. So I go to talk to the front desk. Hey, this guy, like, left his laptops here. Can I, like, turn them into the front desk? No. Okay, so it becomes like 11 o'clock at night, and I'm thinking maybe I should go to bed. I can't take these laptops to my room. What else can I do here? So
okay.
I'm like talking with the front desk, and they tell me you should call the police.
Did you do that?
Yeah. And then the police came out. And I had a very nice conversation with the police, and they understood exactly where I was coming from. It's like, I literally have like $3,000 in laptops here. If I walk them up to my room, it could be considered that I stole them. The front desk won't accept them. We can't find the guy who they belong to. So what am I supposed to do here?
He told you to take them up to his room, didn't he?
No. What they did was they took them into custody.
Ah. Well, that then it had a happy ending.
Sort of. Like, for me, it did. Like, for him, he's going to have to go pick them up at the police station.
So just like in chess, like when your queen, like, pins a pawn against the king, the guy used those, he pins you to the lobby with the laptops, right?
Pretty much. And what I'm really waiting for is this guy's probably going to be really pissed off at me because now he has to go to the police station to pick up his laptops. Of course, it's 3 o'clock the following afternoon and I still have not found him.
You know, somewhere there's a guy going, I wonder what happened to those laptops I had the other day. Was he an old person? Like, you could have dementia, I think.
Oh, I think it's better than that. So he had actually given me a t-shirt. I have it here.
Oh. Whoa, wow, man.
And I can tell you that he certainly was not smoking cigarettes out
there. So I do not consider myself a druggie by any means. I experimented when I was a kid. But cannabis is now legal in Virginia. Yay. And my son-in-law decided he was going to grow some cannabis. So last Christmas, he brings me a little jar of cannabis. I say, cool thing, dude. I appreciate that. I don't really smoke, but I can't sleep sometimes. Maybe I can use it. He said, this is called Gorilla Glue. You smoke some of this and it just sticks you to wherever you are. You don't move. I guess sounded okay, like for sleeping. I mean, I really want to kind of stay in bed. Now you're gonna like this, okay? So last Friday, yeah, it's about 10 o'clock, and I'm feeling kind of jazzed up. I don't want to go to sleep. So I eat some of this Gorilla Glue because I don't want to smoke because I'm not a druggie, right? I lost the ability to speak. Oh, man. It was not good. I just kind of sat there like, I don't really want to do that again, but it I guess it works on gorillas. I don't know.
Well, what's really funny with me is that when I was much, much, much younger, let's say like teenager, I used to smoke a good amount of marijuana. And then I stopped because I worked for the military, sure. I did other things, and you couldn't. It was just not possible. And you reach a point where you've kind of stopped doing all of those kinds of things. But then maybe once a year, you go out with a group of friends and it's there and you're like, oh yeah, I remember that. Maybe I should have a little bit. And it's like, oh, let me just take one hit. Oh.
Well, you know, it's funny because even though I quit, I just couldn't smoke it back in the day because it messed with my personality too much. But when it became legal and my son-in-law and son decided to start growing it, I felt like I'd been put upon, like I had to like be He-Man, because I'm like, oh yeah, I've smoked that stuff back in the day when you couldn't do it, dang it. So
What you didn't realize is that back in the day when we used to smoke it, it was about 15% as powerful as what they're smoking today.
Actually, I do realize that now. I did not realize that last week. And, you know, it's been like 4 months, so, you know, it's not like I do it all the time. I'm going to, I guess, dump it out. I don't know. It's a weird situation. But, of course, when they come back, I'm like, oh, hell yeah, I did all that like in a day or something.
Oh, so I've got a good one for you. Many years ago, when I used to live in New Orleans, I lived with two roommates. Sometimes three roommates, but at the time it was two roommates. And one night, there was a bit of LSD that went around. And everyone was reasonably cool, except for one roommate. The problem was that one roommate was also, I forget whether he was a brown 3 or a black belt at this point.
Oh, no.
And he was running around with a Kwan Dao.
Is that like a knife?
It's more like a pole with a giant knife on top of it.
Because that would be better than a pole or a knife, but a pole and a knife.
Well, and what do you do at this point?
Well, personally, I have a strategy for unforeseen situations. It's called run like a frightened child. Sometimes it consists of waving my arms at the same time.
That is pretty much what everyone did.
Yeah, the drugs, I think they were way oversold in our youth for like what they could do. Because, you know, we had like Timothy Leary. We had a lot of people who were supposed to be looked up to. It told us that there's this whole counterculture of all these things we could do and become one with nature. Turned out there were just a lot of stoner dudes who went to college. It's kind of disappointing now looking back on it.
What's hilarious is he never lived that night down.
Yeah, I don't. That's why we really don't talk about drug usage even at all. This is the first time I mention it in public because people, you know, they don't take kindly to that kind of stuff. It's weird how that stuff will stick with you as far as a reputation goes. You tell people you're Jesus just that one time, and then it's from then on. I mean. Okay, so by the way, what I've been doing this past week, I finished up the Lord of the Rings. I've started on another book called. Ingenuity Gap.
It must be a good book.
It's the Ingenuity Gap. It should be the Memory Gap, since I couldn't remember the title. It's Ingenuity Gap, written in 1997, about how technology is advancing faster than our ability to process it. 25 years ago.
Well, I'm curious. What are your thoughts on how true that was?
I at first was going to bail on the book because the guy just goes through a list of sort of common reasons things are bad, right? And then I realized that the beauty of this book was that his part of his thesis is true, but his examples are all fucked. So what I could do is actually go back 25 years and see which of the examples actually held out to be true and which were bullshit and kind of reverse engineer why he got the answers he had wrong. Which is good, and I actually I'm using the highlighter quite a bit, which is unusual for a book, so it's a good sign.
What is an example that he got correct?
Well, I remember the first thing I captured was an H.G. Wells quote about technology change. It was a beautiful quote. He mentioned six qualities of complexity that a Harvard economist put out in some paper or book I need to look up, and those six qualities of complexity are actually true in my co-cognitive load metric, the hexagonal architecture stuff. Those six metrics can be applied in a whole bunch of places. And I'm like, way cool, because this is something I can use. I'm actually thinking about combining those six attributes and Kinefin into an explanation of the onion architecture. I didn't mean to get too nerdy, but that's kind of where I'm going with that. So yeah, yes, he ran across some good nuggets of stuff. It's just that he was too current. He was too chatty and current. He was a beautiful writer. He tells all these wonderful stories that I'm sure at the time people loved. But the problem is, by making it so relevant to the times, he ended up making it relevant to the times, and it looks like yet another one of those books from 20, 30 years ago that says the world is ending. Yeah, it's like, then I interviewed Joe, who said that, you know, the koala bears are going, whatever. It's just story after story of thing that didn't happen, or it was or ozone hole. We're stuck with an ozone hole. It's going to get bigger and bigger, and we're all going to die of skin cancer. Okay. Kind of embarrassing. You know, I feel about it. I read a book on a biography of Thomas Jefferson last year, and the guy hated Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson's one of my big fans. And I loved the book because it was fun to go through and see somebody who hated Jefferson talk about all his faults and go, okay, yeah, he's right there, but he's missing his other part. And so by seeing the other, sometimes by seeing the author's holes in their reasoning, you can actually understand your own case much better.
Well, yeah, and Jefferson was a rather complicated individual.
Very much so, and much of the attacks against him was he was a complicated. I mean, you know, he pouted, and he was an artist. He was a philosopher. He was an artistic person, probably one of the most artistic presidents we had, and that's not necessarily makes for a good president. Okay, so this first story is awesome. Another species of hominin may still be alive. I saw this and I thought, Bigfoot, is this going to be finally, we're going to finally find Bigfoot and get a picture of him? Because that guy takes sucky ass pictures. But no. This says an anthropologist is making the case that the Denosians that we found on that island, little short people in a cave a while back, local legend has it those folks are still alive in Grandpa's time. And this guy said, well, if they hated human contact, and if the reports of them being alive in Grandpa's time is true, dude, we actually may have some little hobbit dudes kind of hiding out somewhere.
Oh, no. So long as they don't go after the ring.
Yeah, or use the eagles. I mean, come on, already. You got the giant eagles, just fly into Mordor. I found this, like I said, this is really neat because, well, yeah, I guess if those rumors are true, then, and the guys don't like people, and it's an overgrown jungle, the hard to find people to begin with, it's quite possible that there could be another species of it. So this next one is sort of another one in our string of physics is dead, physics has changed, physics is new now, physics sucks, I love physics, why do I hate physics so much? Basically, the long and short of this essay is, you know, I'm like, this author's maybe 50, 60 years old, the stuff he read about physics, the problems it had, and all that back in the 80s, still true, nothing has changed, and we still have the same problems, yet we have all these people with PhDs who are supposedly learning new stuff. Something should be changing more than it currently is.
Well, to be fair, it has been changing. It's just been changing in five different paths. Yeah. We're just not sure which one of those five paths is correct.
Yeah, if I had to sort of elaborate further on this guy's reasoning, it's that we convinced the governments in the world to build these huge colliders because we wanted to find more particles. More particles, yay. And then we spent billions of dollars in tens of years and just sort of found the particles we're already looking for. We probably should have spent some more time, you know, exploring other avenues.
Well, I think I've mentioned this before, but the LHC actually runs a vent store.
Whoa. Actually, one of the examples in the book the guy uses was the one of the LHCs, the early version that was in just in Europe, or just in England. I forget what the name of that was, but there was a early collider built in England before the LHC that was pretty complex.
We're not used to obviously capture all of the data read. We're part of the control system.
Yeah, and
that would be a lot of messages per second to capture everything that actually happens during a collision.
I have this dream, like a sci-fi book, of somebody who finally builds a computer that like predicts where the computational universe is going to go ahead of time, so that you can then like change reality. It's of course completely impossible, but it just sounds so cool.
I'm pretty sure there are some books and movies about this.
I don't know. I know that there's some sci-fi shows streaming now about computers that can predict human behavior ahead of time. That's sort of the old Asimov gimmick with Foundation. But what I was really thinking is a computer that could actually predict quantum effects at scale. So it would say like, hey, get this butterfly to flap its wings here and you'll have a tornado across the world. It's an amazing, stupendously big amount of computational power needed. It's a fun thought experiment.
Oh, but how big is this computer?
I don't know, but I know it's going to be running JavaScript. We're not getting ever getting away from JavaScript, okay? So this next article is, what computational universe do we live in? And no, it's not JavaScript, even though I was really expecting it to be. This is the five types of universes the cryptographers think we could have if we were living in a computable universe. And the water gets way deep here, my friend. But I think that, you know, we talked last week about Wolfram and him doing, he's doing these nodes of computation at the sub-lepton level. If those things actually exist, he posits that the universe is non-computable. And because it's not, even though it's a computer, it is non-computable. And if that's true, you can actually be cryptographically impenetrable and computable at the same time. So There may be multiple answers to this question. This is the old I can reason how the computer operates bit by bit, but I can't tell how the aggregate operates because there's too much random noise.
Well, wouldn't this just be quantum computing in general?
Yes, it would. The thing is that at a level that we cannot measure, it operates in a reproducible manner, sort of a Newtonian clockwork type thing. But because we can't measure it at that level, that finally at the point we get to a level we can look at, then we got quantum mechanics, and we're back to sort of probability theory. If that makes sense. You know, I kind of
today, it makes sense, but that would preclude our possibility from being able to measure it.
There you go. See, this is the parallel universe problem. It's like if you answer your problem with parallel universe and we can't see the parallel universe, then really it's just magic turtles.
Come on, don't use the term parallel universe. It's multiverse.
Multi-metaverse. Yeah. So the problem is that if it exists outside of our ability to see it, then we're basically saying it doesn't exist. It's the same difference. It's magic turtles. It's this whole thing. So the deal is going to be with any of this stuff, can you test it or not? And one of the things that they're looking for is P versus NP problems. And that is problems that can be solved in algebraic time versus problems that cannot be solved.
And that's been out there for some years.
Yeah. And even if you figure out if P equals or doesn't equal NP, then you still don't know what the universe is. You just know that it may be at some point computable in a reproducible fashion instead of a random fashion, I think.
Oh, well, the big one there is if you could prove that P equals NP. That would completely revolutionize humanity.
It would. We would go back to a Newtonian type thing. But see, the thing is, like I was saying, that you could have P equal NP at the subquark level and just be an incomplete problem that can never be solved at the atomic level, which kind of leaves us with a kind of big bag of nothing. The answer could be both.
Your maps would come up a lot faster.
I want my Wordle to be a lot better too, because some of those words on Wordle pissing me off. Okay, I just really, Lori is a fucking English word. It's not a real American word. By the way, James every morning sends me a copy of Quirtle that we talked about a few weeks ago, and I send him my copy and we compare notes. James is quite a pretty good. He's a good Quirtle player. He knows some words. So the next one, if we can build a real transversible wormhole, but only if the universe has extra dimensions. And I threw this in here because this is, like I said, yet another long string of articles of people who want their warp drive and they know math and they're going to take math and beat it up against the problem as much as they have to until they get their warp drive. And I just think it's a fascinating look at how humans are kind of get clued into something or sort of focused on something until they can finally figure it out.
What I kind of like about it is, and this is a very mathematical perspective of things, I have shown that providing reality is this thing, that this would be possible.
Yes.
It does not mean it's actually possible.
Yeah, it's kind of like the concept of negative sheep. I mean, you have to have the concept, but you can't really have a negative sheep. But to put that differently, math is self-consistent, and when it maps to real-world things, it's very useful, but it also maps to things that could never exist in the real world, and that doesn't make math any less useful. It just means that parts of math are never going to, exist in reality.
Oh, come on. I know, you just want to hold in your hand a pile of I.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll never forget that E to the pi I thing. I still think, and the Monte Carlo problem. I mean, that dude, that's really some messed up. You know the Monte Carlo problem, right?
Yep.
The Monty Hall problem.
Yeah.
That's just, I understand it. I grasped it. I proved it for myself. And it is still the devil's spawn and evil, my friend. It just doesn't, something about that does not feel right to me.
Well, the Monte Carlo problem is also fun.
I know the Monte Carlo, like, simulation technique.
Yeah.
Well, the Monty Hall problem is the thing about guessing on the price on the Let's Make a Deal show.
Correct.
Yeah. Yes, that's just bad. Bad. Okay, so this next article is, after 5 years, I'm out of the serverless compute cult. You can just hear, like, the pearls being clasped and sort of verklempt yelling. You guys are in a cult and I'm not going to be part of it anymore.
Well, what's hilarious is the serverless cult had come up, and then a lot of us had said, well, what you guys are doing is good,
yeah,
but we need to put some limits on where it's good.
I think...
And then it was, no, it's always good. It's like, well, no, here's a concrete case where it might not necessarily be useful.
Yeah, people buy the slogan.
Well, and you can see it with everything in technology. I have literally watched people tell me that everything should be done with Agile, and it's like, well, yeah, no. Everything should be done with serverless. Yeah, no.
Yeah, or everything should be done with events. Yeah, no.
No. What I don't understand is why we as humans tend to go to extremes like this. We tend not to see the middle ground of there are pros and cons of all of these things. And where should I choose one?
And that was the reason I put this here. I like essays like this. Now, this is not the only one I've done, but because they tell me the difference between the thing itself and the way the thing itself is actually being received by the market who uses it. And so the thing itself is just serverless, which is basically pure functions. If you have to take this guy's list of 6 things, it's probably number 3, Lambda. That's serverless. That's the thing itself. The rest of this shit's just a bunch of bullshit that you have to add on top of pure functions in any sort of computing environment. It really has nothing to do with serverless. It's just the framework that AWS, in this case, provides around network access to pure serverless stuff. But because he didn't understand this, all of this is thrown together in one big honking bag and called a serverless cult. And that tells me that the community is sort of consuming it that way, too.
That's reasonable.
I get the same thing. I had a discussion a year ago about microservices, and the guy was like, "Yeah, but how do you set your Docker image up for that microservice?" I'm like, "Why do you need a Docker image for a microservice?" He's like, "Yeah, but you have to have a new Docker image for every microservice, and they exist in a Kubernetes pod group." I'm like, "Why?" Like, you feel like you should do like the sign language. What part of this involves Docker?
I've had another one there where someone told me that microservices need to work over HTTP.
I've heard that too, yeah.
And it's like, well, why? If I write a microservice and it happens to interact over UDP multicast, how does that make it not a microservice?
Yes, and even worse, by mixing it together with some other bullshit, which you're going to have to do, no doubt, but by mixing it all together in one big bag, you don't understand microservices no more. You just got it all, you've got coupled into a bunch of other bullshit.
Well, I think a big part of the problem is for the people who are defining microservices. If you do not include all of these things, the book would have only been like 60 pages long.
Yes. I agree. I think that if you just wrote about serverless code or just wrote about microservices, it would be a very short book. And authors probably feel like they need to provide some sort of a concrete example on doing this. And so they go back and pull some bunch of standard bullshit out and throw it in. And now you got a 300-page book that shows you how to do microservices or HTTP or serverless inside AWS or whatever. And people consume that thinking that's the way you do it. But that's not really the thing. That's just the thing inside some example for you.
Well, but the other side of the problem is, who would really buy a 150-page book? It's like, oh my God, this thing's so short, it can't possibly have anything worthwhile in it.
And I think even worse is that we talked about, you know, serverless being number three of this list. Those other five items are also problems you need to solve, no matter what you're doing. And those are also skills you'll need to learn that are not related to going serverless. So it's, you know, it's... serverless doesn't solve your problems. It just sort of locates certain types of problems in certain places. You still got a bunch of freaking work to do.
Yep.
Okay, so I already told you about this next article. This is Pointers Are Complicated 3 or Pointer Integer Casts Exposed. And so I included this because of the phrase pointer provenance. If you guys aren't familiar with the word provenance, provenance is the word they use when they talk about an antique. It's the story of where the thing came from, so that you know that it's a real antique. So I just had this vision of, well, my grandmother had this pointer back in the day, and I inherited it from my uncle. It's just, it has, provenance is a weird word. I understand why it's needed, but it's an odd word to apply to pointers.
It's not actually that odd. So, being able to show I have a pointer and it was created here, then it was referenced here, then it was referenced there, is actually a very, very valuable thing. Think back to when you're in university and you're building your first binary tree.
Oh my God, yeah, I agree that it's an important thing. It just seems like a word. And that's probably the best word to use. I don't know if there's a better word, but his point, this is about language design, and it uses Rust as the language example language. But his point is that in Rust or other languages, if you create a pointer, the compiler or the language itself has to keep other stuff in there about that pointer, and that other stuff has to travel with that pointer throughout the rest of the code. And that is an extremely important thing to understand that I never learned in C, but it's true for language design. He's got a great example of using integer pointers at some point down here. Now, here we go. So he's got some pointers and one pointers. One pointer references another pointer, references a third pointer, and it's all a bunch of fun. And what he's saying in this example is that most people would say that this is sort of a pointer type A, pointer type B, pointer type C example. B is never used. So they would say, hey, the compiler should just take away B because it's never used. He's like, no, because you did the pointer casting from A to B, from B to C, you actually changed the provenance of pointer C. And it's a technical point, but it's like, yeah, we just can't keep pointers like we used to. It's going to be more complicated. You know.
Oh, come on. Back when I was learning C, we learned pointers as they can basically point to anything.
You know, I wonder if that's just not a better way of doing it to begin with. Because it seems like it's either don't show them pointers, you know, let's just keep it hidden, or we'll show them pointers and try to make it safe by making it like this complex piece of shit that, you know.
Well, the really fun ones that you could do were things like, okay, so let's say that I defined a char array inside of my function. It was 4 characters. And then I put a pointer to the beginning of that char array, and then I added 8 to it. And then I knew that I had my char array, and I had an int32 afterwards, and another int32 afterwards, and it would point to the second int32. Who would not want to be able to do these kinds of things just based on the order the variables were declared?
Yeah, you can even get into the instructions. You can actually figure out that the first instruction is going to be a move or whatever, and then you can actually take the pointer somewhere else and start changing the code in the function.
Who would not want to be able to do this kind of thing. You can have so much fun with it.
Yeah, well, see, that's what I was saying. Like, just keep it the way it was in C, and let's all have a bunch of hella fun with this, because it is fun. Or they just take it away from people and don't let them see it. But they've tried to find some weird middle ground where, like, pointers do everything, but some things no. It's like, I don't know. Seems like you just take it away.
You're not really having fun until you jump to pointers.
Yeah, where you do your first virtual function pointer in direction table. That's a fun time that I know we all remember. First time I flew an airplane, first time I dated a girl, first time I did virtual function pointers. And you know, speaking of metadata, those virtual function pointers had better have a function signature associated with them. God knows what the hell you're going to be doing to the stack. Right? So you say, I've got a virtual function pointer, takes an integer, returns an integer, then you make another function pointer that takes, I don't know, say a long byte and returns an integer. Then you can stick that up there. And all of a sudden, now you're shoving more stuff in the stack, calling the same function, and now it doesn't have the thing it thought it was going to get. That function has extra stuff.
Everything you just said made total and complete sense, except for a long byte.
Yeah.
What is a long byte?
Yeah, double, I guess, a 64-bit. the thing is, they've changed it so much, I'm not really sure what the types are anymore. Well, the double would be 64-bit float, maybe? 64-byte float? I don't know. I don't remember. So the next article is this guy assembled a bunch of stuff for Linux, utilities that they left out. And some of these were kind of cool. Some of them were just kind of stupid. But they were interesting to see. I like a couple of them. I might want to try them. The Sponge one looked interesting, and Vipe looked kind of cool. So the Sponge command takes something from a file and sends it back to the file, which is normally a really bad thing to do. I imagine it uses maybe some sort of temp file under the hood, which is the way you typically do that. But it is very convenient if you know you're not going to have any errors.
Because you always know you're not going to have any errors when you're writing command line.
I never have. Yes, of course. Well, Vipe may be interesting. Vipe inserts a text editor into the pipe, and the example used was, if I want to check in a bunch of files, I just go git, like message, pipe that to Vipe, and then the text editor comes up each time to ask you a message. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The text editor comes up the list of things it would normally send to the command, and you can delete items and mung it around and save, and it sends that on out to the command. So you can actually edit a list of stuff coming through the pipe in your text editor before it goes back out to the rest of the pipe. That sounds pretty cool.
That actually does sound pretty cool. But I wonder, does it actually work on standard out or standard error?
Look at that. And there's also some tools under consideration that were kind of neat. It's weird because when you look at the hackers talk about this, as you know, most all these can be duplicated in one way or another. And so they come out of the woodwork, all these nerds from far back, you know, wearing their sandals and their like shirts and hats and stuff. And they say, well, no, you know, really, you just should be doing this old way instead of with these new fancy commands I got today. And that was fun in its own thing just to watch those guys. Okay, Greg, so this next one. This goes out to Greg, because we got message queue. I really like this article a lot. This guy teaches simple message queuing by using the command line. And in a very short amount of time, he shows how message queues work. And that was awesome.
It was actually pretty cool.
I'm saving that. There was another article. It was about my toughest interview question ever. And I didn't post it here because I don't want to know the answer. But it was about memcaching key value stores, and it looked really cool, and I want to like maybe do that next week or something. But it was, I think you could do you can use memcache from the command line, where you like cache dog equals 7 for 30 seconds, and it would keep that for you. So actually using those two in parallel, you could do some sort of caching queuing system combined without actually writing very much code. It would be bad. Don't get me wrong, it's not a production system at all, but it could show you how such things work.
So what was your most difficult interview question?
I was interviewing Cap 1, and the guy gave me a units conversion question. It had about a dozen different units in it, and he wanted me to solve it on the board, and I had about, I don't know, 6 cups of coffee, and I had no sleep, and I flailed like a dying squid. It was horrible. How about you?
Well, I was going to say, did he make you memorize the conversion units? So, like, we want to convert inches to furlongs, and you need to know off the top of your head how many inches are in a furlong.
That's really what got me. I think he would have told me the conversion factors, and I know from chemistry that you can go through and figure out the unit conversions by just using units for denominators. But the problem was it was just too many different pieces of stuff to track at the same time, along with the questions about the conversion ratios. If I'd had a day or just sort of relaxed, it would have been fine. But being like one of these, solve the problem, monkey! I folded, bud. Like, dance, little monkey, dance! And I did not dance.
Oh, come on. You could have some fun with conversion ratios. As an example, I could ask you to convert gallons to furlongs.
Given some miles per gallon, perhaps. You could just do the energy conversion, the chemistry energy, or you could
given
do...
Given a number of ants who are carrying it.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, do you remember your toughest question?
I've had a couple of them that were just bizarre.
Nothing right off the bat. You're failing the question about the tough question that you failed.
No. I'm trying to remember the precise wording of it. This was way back when I was maybe early 20s. And it was assuming that we are on a RISC processor. How would you better implement a binary search? I believe that was the precise question.
And this would be in C?
So it's not saying precisely what you should do. It's just saying we're on a RISC processor and you need to do a binary search.
So you sort of set up your own coding and you said, look, I'm going to use C or...
Well, but it's also, this isn't necessarily an array. This could be a tree.
Right. Right, yeah. So you speaking of virtual function pointers, because we just came back to the same topic again. It's funny because I had this 2-day interview once. I went down to Austin, Texas, and it was this brutal thing. They're going to make sure they got the right person. It was a hoot. All I did was just riff about the current technology. At that point, I think it was model-driven development, OO. And I just riffed on that for 2 days. Had a blast. They loved me.
To be fair, you were in Texas. They probably just liked the hat.
Could have been. I remember once I got the gig, I went out and saw a mariachi band, which is the first time I saw that. That was pretty wild. Yeah, it's funny that the types of interviews you think may be tough were not that tough. And then the things that you think would be pretty easy, it's like, just for some reason, at times you just freeze up. I don't know why. So this next story is Google Maps has opened satellite images of all strategic sites in Russia. If you guys don't know, satellite companies have been fuzzing certain parts of the globe because countries don't want you looking at them, and that's probably good for everybody. But Google has decided in their infinite wisdom that nope, we should be able to see all the stuff going inside Russia. I'm fine with this because I'm really kind of pissed about the war, but who the hell's Google make this decision? They're going to do this about the U.S. If the U.S. does something they don't like it, this is a worldwide implications type thing. I'm not happy that they're able to do that. That's just feels too weird to me. You can also look at the nuclear ammunition storage.
What you more have to wonder about is, once they've said that they will do this, what type of system are they going to open for non-disclosure payments to governments? So we will assure you that we will not disclose this information if you pay us $27 million per month.
Million dollars. Yeah, and it goes the other way, too. It's like, okay, you want to work in France? Cool, we'll let you operate in France. We just want you to defuzz all the pictures of Japan or whatever. So countries that normally couldn't afford satellite data can actually blackmail companies. You don't get to do business in our country unless you show us this stuff. So, you know, once you... Twitter and some of these other guys are like, you know, we have the magic algorithm, and the algorithm controls all, the algorithm knows all. Google here is just admitting, hey, we just made a decision. And it's like, okay, you just made a decision. Now that means you have the power to make that decision, which means you are a player, bub.
Well, and we really need to consider that when we look at companies like Google and Facebook, they operate at a nation state level.
It's true. If you want to know why Facebook does the things it does, study Augustus Caesar. The Caesar came after Julius Caesar, the guy who consolidated the empire and made the Roman Empire what it was. That was one of Mark's heroes. And if you look at that guy, the things he did, you look at Facebook, it's like, oh, I get it now. It's just really wild looking at, like, nuclear aircraft carriers with the nuclear weapons exposed. It's just a weird, weird thing. I feel like we should be, like, in a Tom Clancy novel or something. What are those doors for? Okay, so we're getting kind of the more fun part of the thing. Today I learned the FBI has an 83-page guide to internet speak. And I could just see, like, some guy in a suit and tie with, like, a book going, hello, internet person. I am cool dude. It's like, oh, God.
This is an utterly hilarious one. It's, do you know the commercial where there's the, I'm trying to remember the name of the actor, and he's coming in and he's like, hey, guys. Pretending to be a high school student?
I stopped ringing a bell.
But he's like 40.
Yeah, like a map. It's man, alien, predator. Like, where the hell are we getting this shit at?
Well, I think there's a lot of other good ones there, like TBM.
Tactical
boyfriend mentioned.
And 420 is just drugs in general. It's nothing to do with pot, just drugs.
Well, that one I can at least kind of understand.
That's just sad. Funny, you can think of various ones and then wonder if they actually have it.
What's really weird with all these acronyms is that any human is going to be in at least 3 to 5 groups. And in these 3 to 5 groups, there's going to be varying acronyms that tend to overlap. Where you have to read it and read it in context.
So I had one we used growing up. It was Dilligaff. We used Dilligaff quite a bit. It does. Do I look like I give a frack? And they don't even have that. They have a Dilligad. Do I look like I give a darn? They must have been sort of the home improvement or McLean's version of the internet. Like, DG, don't go. Just say, don't go. It's, I don't know. I think maybe, you know, 30, 40, you know, I know, SMH, shaking my head. I mean, LOL, LMAO, there's some to know. And then, you know, there's this whole meme culture coming out with the smiley emoticons and the pictures. I'm not even sure a glossary would work for anything. To your point, you really need to be part of that culture and just follow along for a while.
Well, and it can oftentimes become very, very confusing. Because things mean different things.
Yeah, we used hosed. I've used hosed quite a bit. Talk about programs or a computer that barfed something to be like a stack dump. And I don't think other people use that. That's probably not even used with hackers anymore.
Well, let me just try an example in spoken word. So if I were to tell you the word fart, what would that mean to you?
Flatulence.
Okay, in Polish it means good luck.
Did they tell you that last time you went to Poland?
Yes, they did.
Okay. And do they laugh every time you use the word? No, you of course are correct. I learned to do icons back when computers were international, and the rule then, I think it was early 90s. Never use an icon with a hand in it, because anything you do with a hand is somewhere in the world profane. Now, this stop actually means here's excrement in your face to some people. So you cannot make a hand gesture without insulting somebody or another. Okay, so last serious article is the case for American seriousness. And this is an article, an essay given to other people who invest money in projects. And Catherine Boyle says, you know, we can do some pretty cool stuff if we stop being a bunch of dumbass trivial people online and actually go solve problems. And I completely agree with her.
It's rather hard to disagree with.
Yeah, I think that probably the more subtle way of putting this is that there's so much entertainment anymore that sort of passes as some other thing. Political activism, financial advice, whatever, news. There's all these categories of material that we think we're consuming different types of things, and it's all just the same emotionally manipulative marketing entertainment. That's all it is. And so you really, her point's true, but it's not complete. The complete part is that we need to be able to discern the type of thing that we need to consume to do our work from just things that are just there to waste our time.
Oh, come on. When's the last time you went and used HipMunk?
Used what, HipMunk? At Twitter, it's my only bad thing right now. I get on every now and then, and I'm still sorry. I've got maybe four popular people I follow. Elon Musk is one of them, and it's just too much fun to watch him yanking everybody's chain for me to, like, get up, not go on anymore. He's got like a bazillion dollars. He's like, hey, maybe I'll just buy Twitter. And then everybody goes crazy, and it I hate to say that's entertaining, but it is a bit entertaining. One person, Elon said to him, hey, you know, maybe I'll just buy Twitter. And of course, I don't know if he's serious or not. Don't know, don't care. But one person replied, well, if you do that, Elon, I will just time I leave Twitter. I will be gone. And somebody replied, this isn't a bus, Jason. You don't have to tell people like when things are departing or arriving. We're fine. We'll be okay. Like, oh, wow, what a nice way. But, you know, I have been online for many years, and I've heard many of these, well, if this happens, I'm leaving things. And it's like, yeah, okay, if you're leaving, we'll miss you somehow. It's...
Well, it's not only online. You hear this a lot in person as well. I heard people both on the left and on the right say they were going to move to Canada or move to Australia, whether Clinton won or whether Trump won. And it's like, you know what? You're not going to do that. Shut up.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking more about this because that thing in the reply kind of struck home with me. And, you know, it occurs to me, Greg, there's just a ton of apathy in the world because nobody really gives a shit about what each of us are doing. And that's fine with me. I understand it's a big world and all that. But it's very difficult for a lot of people to get their head around that, like, every time you tweet something, you're interacting with maybe 10,000 people who give a shit that you're even a person, for that matter. And so a lot of times this can lead to a lot of emotional fits, trying to get attention. And I understand that. There's a need there somewhere.
Are you suggesting that as we move forward in technology, that psychology is going to become the main factor?
Well, I think it already has. I think more to the point is that each of us are going to have to mature to the point that we realize that it's probably better to be in a small social group where we can interact on a regular basis and sort of validate and check each other what we're doing than is to try to be this world, like everybody can't be their own New York Times because it's a thankless job. There's no way you're going to create enough bullshit or momentum to actually get any sort of readers. If you do, you're going to become a fake, shallow, sick person. You know, that's the nature of modern communication.
Expecting large groups of people to learn difficult lessons is fraught with failure historically.
Well, not only learn a lesson, it's just that, you know, I don't think, you know, anybody really wants to teach. This is the seriousness problem. People are not online to solve problems. People are online to vent or to get followers. And this is an emotional thing. This is entertainment in various forms, masquerading as, well, like I said, a bunch of other shit that they say it's supposed to be, but it's not. And I think the root of that, you know, if you really want to solve that, people need to accept the fact that your life is a puny little piece of shit that nobody cares about, and that's okay. And I'm an existentialist, so I'm happy with that. You know, you're going to be here a second and gone, and nobody gives a shit. This is my starting point of life, and from here I have to define meaning, and I'm okay. But damn, it's kind of hard for a lot of people to do. And I get it. I wonder if we shouldn't keep Twitter and Facebook around for people just to get angry at and vent at one another, and we just sort of, you guys go play by yourself. Thank you, because you're never going to fix that.
Just remember, if you are lonely when you're alone, you're in bad company.
This is true. I was happiest. There was a Robert H. Solomon does a existentialism and you course on the teaching company. It's, I think, 18 half-hour courses. Best damn thing I listen to. It's just about how you're responsible for finding meaning, and the more you look to be validated by other things outside you, it's a world of pain in the end. Because even if you get what you want, you don't get what you want. It never works out. Speaking of important scientific problems that need to be addressed, these are a couple of students from MIT that are starting the new science of Oreology, which is investigating the mystery of why Oreo cream fillings usually sticks to just one side. And I have to say that I'm eagerly awaiting the answer to this. They designed a 3D printed do-it-yourself real monitor to actually experiment with Oreos.
When I saw this, I had to giggle. Not because of what they're studying, but the fact that they managed to get this through a committee.
I read this and I told my wife, and I'm like, this reminds me of the buttered toast cat machine. You've heard of that one, right? It's like cats always fall on their feet. Buttered toast always falls buttered down. So we'll just glue toast to a cat and it'll like spin it's like anti-gravity. And I swear I found a video of a real video with a cat and he puts a toast on the cat and the cat just spins in the air in place. It's hilarious.
But as I understand, this is actually being submitted as an actual paper.
It is, and people, like, this gets back to you guys go do your thing. I mean, this is somebody going to want to know about these cookies 100 years from now when the great cookie wars start. We're going to be prepared, and the Russians are not, because we're going to know these things.
But can you imagine going into your job interview 2 years later, and they're like, oh, so what did you write your dissertation on? Well, it was about Oreos.
Well, that's when you say, well, it's a military secret. I really just can't share it with anybody. Sorry about that. It does. Yeah, it, I don't know. I think that you can be so bad that you're good. So, like, yeah, you go to a job interview, you tell them this story, they're gonna tell their friends. They're going to love this thing. It's like a commercial for you.
Yeah, but they're probably not going to hire you.
Well, if they're Nabisco, they will. Yeah, it's funny because the argument usually made is we need pure research because we don't know when we actually need that research. And I have a deep feeling in my heart, Greg, at some point we're going to need to know these cookie questions need answers.
It's entirely possible.
Yeah, well, a day not far from now, you may find yourself in the street, a dark alley, saying, "Don't come at me with that cookie." It could happen, okay? Now you could be prepared. You could be prepared here. Yeah, you're right. It is interesting how many things end up. You start with somewhere simple, and you end up way down. And this is fluid dynamics, and this. I mean, there's real shit in here. I mean, not in the cookie, of course, but I mean, it's real stuff.
What I'm just laughing at, it's on the first page. The cookie is defined via pie.
I saw something, what was it? It was a couple of weeks back. It was like, you know, what is it? Is pizza a cracker or is pizza a donut? And they had this whole discussion of, you know, what's a cracker, what's a donut, what's a sandwich? You know, like a taco and a pizza, are they the same thing? You got one piece of kind of bread and you got some stuff in there. If you fold the pizza slice you fold the pizza slice up like that, it's a taco. Same thing.
That is true.
So pizza is just an unrolled taco with marinara sauce. If you get a chance, you should look up the cube way of categorizing sandwiches. So this is a long discussion of how you can use a cube model to figure out what a sandwich is.
Well, and the real question that you start running into is, so if I were to have, let's say, a quesadilla, is a quesadilla pizza?
Yeah, or a calzone, yeah, yeah. A calzone, it's got bread all around it. Isn't it just a sandwich?
Well, but you could also argue that it's a pizza.
Well,
you have pizzas with crust in the top and the bottom.
You do, and you have grinders that have marinara that have a crust on the top and bottom.
Well, but a tortilla, assuming you're going to put salsa on it, also has tomatoes, it has cheese, it has toppings.
Yeah, but that changes per person. Like, if you have a hot dog is not a submarine, is it?
Oh, that depends a lot where you are.
Yeah, see, this is, like I said, starts with simple question. Suddenly you're into, like, sandwich ontology.
No. They literally make hot dog subs.
Oh, I know this, and they're quite yummy. And they make they call them hot dogs, but they slice the bun. You end up with two pieces of bun. See, I got to do this cube thing now because it's bugging me. It's called the Cube Rule. It's cuberule.com. Okay, it's a cube rule of food identification. First, we ask, are hot dogs sandwiches? There we go. About grilled cheese is Reuben's. PBJ is hot dog. The hot dog is by himself. He does not know. Is he a sandwich? Is he not? New York said yes. Yep, there you go. Categorized officially by New York to be a sandwich. Pop-Tarts are a type of ravioli. Then the war began, and this obviously went on for some time. They finally came up with a sign. Oh, there's a sandwich alignment chart. So you got the ingredient purist, ingredient neutral, ingredient rebel across the top. Then you got structure purist, structure neutral, structure rebel. And so if you're a structure purist and an ingredient purist, a BLT is a sandwich, damn it. A sandwich must have, you know, classic toppings and be part of the classic thing. On the other side, if you're an ingredient rebel and you're a structure rebel, a Pop-Tart is a sandwich. So this you can see where the war began, and it's not a pretty thing, not something pretty to look at.
To be honest, you can make a reasonable argument that dim sum can be a sandwich.
I agree with that. An ice cream taco sandwich. Everything, sandwich. Ice cream between waffles, sandwich.
Ice cream between waffles is actually pretty good.
Oh yeah, some of this is quite yummy, yeah. Then spake the holy prophet Phosphodide. And you should follow the cube rule. And then here we all learn the cube rule. Blessing us with a grand unified theory of food identification. And so you basically picture a cube in your mind. And a cube, of course, has six sides to it. And depending on which sides actually have the starch, there are different types of sandwiches. And like, if the bottom only has the starch, it's toast. If the bottom and top have the starch, it's a sandwich. And so this is a very simple system we can use to categorize everything. It makes sense, easy to understand.
No, it doesn't.
Popular examples of toast are pizza, nigiri sushi, and pumpkin pie slice. All toast. Sandwiches, quesadilla, toast, and Victoria sponge cake. All sandwiches. A taco, hot dog, sub sandwich, slice of pie. It's a taco on its side because it's a like a cherry taco laying down. It's a slice of pie. Okay, sushi, falafel wrap, pigs in a blanket, form of sushi. Enchilada, form of sushi. We have quiche, we have cheesecake is a quiche, soup is a quiche, and a falafel pita, also a quiche. Because it only has the one side open. A quiche bonus round, deep dish pizza, quiche, a salad in a bread bowl, quiche, key lime pie, quiche, all quiche around, quiche all around. If they've got three starch sides except for the top, it's a quiche. Finally, a calzone is where the starches are on all six sides. Burrito, calzone. Corn dog, calzone. A whole pie is a calzone. But once you slice the pie, you're making tacos, bud. So this answers many, many questions that probably nobody's ever had. And we know that the Pop-Tarts now, we know from the legends of lore that have come down to us, a Pop-Tart is actually a form of calzone. As would be dim sum. And unscrutables. I don't know what unscrutable is.
Well, so the problem here is that dim sum is not one thing.
You know, that's a very good point. They're only showing the noodle part of it. Dim sum is a vast variety of things, of which some are steamed noodles.
Well, and some are puffs, some are...
I know, and actually I believe the vegetables themselves are part of dim sum. Dim sum is a type of eating.
Correct.
Okay, final story. The Attorney General in Boston has said that, you know, you actually cannot lease pets. And, you know, we all lease our phones. We don't own our phones. We lease the software we use. We don't own the software we use. And so some company in Massachusetts said, you know, we're going to start selling pets. But they actually leased the pets to people, and people lost their job, couldn't make payments. And then they said, well, hey, if you can't make a payment, we're going to come get Little Rover. And they were like, what? And yeah, they lease the dogs and cats to people, and it's against the law in like 20 states and legal everywhere else.
So do you know who I think really needs to make this model? It's the ASPCA. They are the best ones capable of doing it.
Yeah, but I wonder if you have a right to repair your pet. Like if your pet needs to go to the vet and you're leasing it. Do you have to upgrade your path if the leasing company decides you must upgrade as a forced upgrade path? Can you like pay a like certain payment every month and get like the latest pet?
Oh, well, that one could be interesting right there.
It's quite fascinating. I was thinking the other day that probably a perfect future city would be built on top like an Amazon distribution center. And the robots would actually deliver things to your house for a period of time. And so everything in your house would be leased for some period of time that you would need it. If you're like having a party, you push a couple buttons and tables and food would show up and people would show up and then they'd come get the stuff back because you don't need, everything would just be there for the time you needed it. Including the dog and cat, looks like. The whole model just scales out wonderfully.
Well, there would be a slight problem with this. Especially when we talk about things like dogs and cats. Demand is elastic.
Yeah.
And many more people would like a dog or cat, let's say, around Christmas than they would want on a random Tuesday in April. So what happens to all these dogs and cats when they are not currently placed inside of a house for the little party that they are being on-demand ordered for?
I believe all of that is magic, and we don't have to worry about it because it all happens by magic. Yeah. How do they build software for your Tesla? And why is it full of bugs that make people die? No, magic, sorry. All magic. No, I agree with you, and I think that this dogs and cats are something people can actually reason about as opposed to like complex software things. You can't, they're things that you should own. And if somebody gets hurt, including the cat or dog, you own this thing, and there has to be some accountability. You should be able to fix your tractor if it doesn't work. If your dog or cat's sick, you should be able to take it to the vet and determine. You know, look at, think about it this way. How about if your dog needs to be put down? Somehow the dog ran away, gets out in the road, gets run over. Are you destroying this other company's piece of property that you're leasing? Do you like owe them more money now? I don't know. And the thing is, right now, this would never work because we have a lot of people who own dogs and cats. 100 years from now, that may or may not be the case. We could easily live in a world. We already live in a world, by the way. In many cities, you can order a box of kittens. Kittens will show up for a party. You play with them for an afternoon, and they come and get the box that afternoon.
Well, but this also gets into a very, very... It's literally like you're walking into a giant hedge of thorns. Because cats and dogs are generally considered sentient. So if I can do that to cats and dogs, can I do that to people?
If I write a robot model that looks efficiently enough like a cat or dog that most people don't care for an hour or two for a party, should they be treated the same as a real cat or dog? I do not know, my friend. It's I do not know. Very, very, very odd question. It's interesting because this is the first time it's froze today. We ask a question about robots and rentals. Suddenly, the thing freezes. Coincidence? I think not. Okay, so Greg is gone. Gone is Greg. I think he was going outside for a smoke. Okay, my friends, I am going to do my goodbye thing instead of just sort of waiting here lamely for him to come back. You have lost yet another hour of your precious time. Watching Nerd Roundup, you could have been starting to be like a nuclear physicist. You could have been building a robot dog that you could lease out to people and come take it if they didn't make payments. You could be doing a lot of things, but you were here with us for the hour and 15 minutes, and we're happy to have you. Greg has come back just in time for me to leave. I am Daniel Markham. I will see you.